Ave podcast listeners, a quick notice before today's episode. A Q&A episode will be recorded in January, so if you have any questions you want answered about Rome or about the podcast, now's your chance. I'll be putting a sticky topic on the Emperors of Rome Facebook page and you can post it there. You can also email them to us at emperorspodcast@gmail.com. Also, if you want to record yourself asking a question, using your phone for example, and email that through, I may use it in the editing. Just make sure you say who you are and where you're from. Thanks to everyone who's listened to the podcast this year and for all the great feedback and comments that you've sent through. We will see you in the new year. And for those wanting to know when we'll return to talking about emperors, the answer is February. So on that note. Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a podcast about the rulers of the ancient Roman Empire. And with me today is Dr. Lily Withercombe, a curator from the National Museum of Australia in Canberra. I travelled north to our nation's capital, where the museum is hosting an exhibition, A History of the World in 100 Objects from the British Museum. Its star attraction, at least in my opinion, is the bronze head of Augustus, the first emperor of Rome. Lily was kind enough to introduce us.
We're standing in front of a head from a colossal bronze statue of the Emperor Augustus. So he's the first emperor of Rome, he's the adopted son of Julius Caesar, and he comes to power after really tumultuous decades in the Mediterranean, periods of civil war, in which he defeats a number of political and military opponents to become the number one man in Rome.
And he was assumably really young when this happened, wasn't he? It's a young-looking statue.
This is the face of a very young man. In 27 BC, around the time that this kind of portrait was actually turned into a kind of canonical form, he's actually about 36 years of age. This man could look somewhat younger, even.
But this is the image that he stuck with throughout his life, isn't it? So whenever you see a statue or an image of Augustus, he always looks this old, no matter. And Augustus did get quite old.
Yeah, that's right. So even at the end of his reign, when he's in his 70s, there's still statue portraits of him throughout the empire where he looks like this. And I think what's really interesting is that a Roman on the street or Roman throughout the empire probably wouldn't have recognised the Emperor Augustus, but they certainly would have recognised this as the Emperor of Rome, the Emperor Augustus. I imagine that with the averted stare, the youthful depiction, he's trying to present himself as a new, vibrant, dynamic, godlike leader. And it's really in contrast with earlier traditions of the Republic where the leaders would represent themselves in what was called a veristic style of portraiture, so coming from the Latin veritas, meaning truth, in which they'd really emphasise their old age and their cares and their worries, and all of this would indicate their wisdom and their status. And so he's breaking with tradition and he's saying, I'm someone new, I'm something new.
So where were these statues then? Where were they placed? Was it everywhere around the empire so that everybody would know who the emperor was?
Yeah, they would have been set up throughout the empire. There would have been tens of thousands of statues like this throughout Rome, in the Forum, in the fora of all the major Roman settlements as well throughout the empire. But also images like this were disseminated on coinage. So this would have been recognisable in all kinds of contexts by all kinds of people.
So is there anything here that gives you that this is distinctively Augustus, that you know you would be able to pick his statue out of a crowd of statues?
Absolutely. So actually when it was first excavated, they thought that it might have been Germanicus, just because of the fine spot. The defining feature on it, which tells us that this is Augustus, is the particular hairstyle. So we have this carefully sort of tousled hairstyle and this parting central fringe. And this is definitive of Augustus. It's actually a hairstyle he's copied from Alexander the Great in earlier portraits. And it's something that sort of gets absorbed into the Julio-Claudian style guide. So all subsequent Julio-Claudian emperors will have some kind of take on this centrally parted fringe. But this is defining of Augustus. You look at this and you know immediately it's Augustus.
So what impression do you get from the statue when you look at it?
Well, it's a very arresting statue, and the impression actually isn't of a very approachable young man. I mean, first of all, it's certainly a young man, but it's a young man who's not, you can't really engage with. So you stand in front of it and you can't actually make direct eye contact with it. At the same time, it's quite an eerie statue head in that the eyes actually follow you all around the room. that's the most arresting part of it. And what I think is interesting, I've been looking at a few literary descriptions of Augustus, and Pliny, Suetonius, they refer to the eyes of Augustus as though he had this kind of remarkable gaze, his really unusual eyes.
And this statue as well would have been quite high up, I suppose, well, on the rest of a body and on a podium as well of some sort, so he'd be looking slightly over people's heads as well, never really looking down at anyone.
Yeah, absolutely. This statue head isn't just from a normal size statue. This comes from a statue that would have been about 8 feet tall, and this accords with our descriptions of what a colossus was. It's a colossal statue. When you think about it, it may have been on a statue base as well. It would have been a really remarkably tall, empowering kind of figure. Then if you were to think about the sort of performance ritual of statues, you know, they were carried through processions, they were carried into temples, then it's even taller, even more majestic.
And it's made of bronze, which I understand is quite rare to find these days because, well, bronze is a valuable metal to survive for 2,000 years without being melted down for handy cannons or anything like that, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's quite remarkable, firstly, that it's a head of Augustus and it's from a colossal statue, but also that it's made of bronze. So yes, this is a very rare material to have survived from antiquity, because you're right, normally it would have been melted down to be used in some kind of military context perhaps, or for other sculptural work as well. And so it's very rare that we found it, but also what's really rare is that the eyes, the inlaid eyes with the calcite irises, have also survived to the present day. And what's remarkable is if you look close up, you can actually see the remains of the eyelashes and this kind of fine detailing I've never seen on a portrait of Augustus before. And it's probably worth mentioning that there's around 250 surviving portrait examples of Augustus, but this is the only one in bronze and the only one with the inlaid eyes.
I never noticed the eyelashes before. You can see them very faintly there.
Yeah.
When you look. That's a great amount of detail to put on a statue that's going to be high above everyone else. I guess they really did put that kind of effort into the impression that they were leaving.
Yeah, this is certainly an example of virtuoso Roman bronze casting.
So this is only the head of a statue. How did it get separated from the body? What happened to the rest of it?
That's right. So this is in fact a decapitated head. It wasn't crafted just as a head on its own, it would have originally been attached to the rest of a body. And there's a really fascinating story as to how it was decapitated. And so it was discovered in 1910 by a British archaeologist called John Garstang, who was the then professor of archaeology at Liverpool University. And it was found in the Sudan, far from Roman settlements. Really a remarkable find. This discovery has been correlated with textual evidence, namely Strabo, the Greek geographer, when he talks about how shortly after the annexation of Egypt, in around 25 BC, the Ethiopian queen, this fierce one-eyed queen that we know as Candace, led a series of incursions into Upper Egypt against the settlements and the forts. And she took captives and she also took a huge amount of statuary. And she took them back to her kingdom and she erected a new temple dedicated to victory. So it's a shrine of victory. Within the foundation context of this, they found this head deliberately decapitated and deliberately buried, and alongside of some gold dust and some gold nuggets as well. It would appear that she'd taken the most valuable statue, so this bronze colossal statue of the Emperor Augustus, she'd decapitated it as a symbol of her victory over the Romans, and she had permanently deposited it beneath the main step leading to this Temple of Victory, so that anytime someone was ascending the stairs to worship at the Temple of Victory, they would literally be walking over the head of the emperor.
That's a very defiant kind of statement that you're making by doing that. What happened? How would Augustus deal with a kind of resistance like that?
Well, it's worth saying that there was an immediate reprisal. So the general Petronius is sent south and he defeats the Ethiopians soundly and also lays reparations on the Kingdom of Ethiopia. And they're so significant that it's only a few years later that the Ethiopians have a delegation that they send to Samos, where Augustus currently is, and they beg for his forgiveness to lift the reparations because they can't actually pay them. And in an act of clemency, a typical act of clemency for this time, I think, he forgives them and he lifts the reparations. And at this point, they actually give back a lot of the statues, we understand from their sources. So they've given back a lot of the loot that they'd originally taken. However, this head remains exactly where it was.
It's a great story, and I love that we've got a piece of evidence to back up a story in a text that's a couple of thousand years old at the moment. So when was this being excavated then? When was this found in the current context?
So John Garstang was working in the Sudan between 1910 to 1914. So he's a British archaeologist. This was a remarkable find. I mean, this made international headlines at the time. And in fact, the Sudanese authorities, even though they had this pre-existing agreement with the British Museum that they would send the most valuable of the treasures discovered to the British Museum, the Sudanese authorities actually tried to have them stay in the Sudan. And Lord Kitchener had to intervene and negotiate sending back this head to the British Museum, along with the gold dust and nuggets. And in fact, Garstang promised that he would make copies of the head and send them back to the Sudan. And he actually doesn't appear to have done this. He did make some copies and he sent them to National Museum Scotland, for example. Didn't fulfil his obligations. But one of the things that was interesting about John Garstang is he had this, it's kind of committee who was actually funding his excavations in return for an annual subscription. And this subscription would collectively support the excavations and also supplemented Garstang's own salary and I guess lifestyle. There would be this big lavish dinner that was hosted in Liverpool. And at this dinner, John Garstang would regale all of the members of the committee with stories of the excavation and talk about the things that he had seen in Sudan and things that he'd found. And at the very end, all of the members of this committee would be given a parcel, and they'd unwrap this parcel, and in it would be some treasures actually from the excavation. So John Garstang had already got into the habit of basically funding the excavation in a way through almost selling them. I should say at this point, this wasn't that unusual at the time. But it set a problematic precedent because, of course, he had this pre-existing agreement that he would actually give this kind of object, you know, this remarkable head, that it should have been given straight to the British Museum. But it would actually appear that he'd almost floated it on the international art market. And so he'd contacted the British Museum and he just casually let them know that a private collector in Paris was interested in purchasing the head for around £5,000. And the British Museum was quite shocked, and there was some subsequent negotiations, and rather than this head being given to the British Museum, it was in the end sold for £1,050. And they actually had to raise the funds externally. It was quite difficult for them to do this, but it was such an important object. It was so beautiful, so unique. They knew they had to have it in their collection. And what's interesting is that John Garstang actually tried to have this information, the fact that he'd sold it, removed from the labelling. He didn't want it to appear as though he'd sold it to the British Museum.
That's Dr. Lily Withercombe, a curator from the National Museum of Australia in Canberra. And you've been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe to it on iTunes. Please leave a review there, as reviews help our rankings and they make us feel appreciated. The exhibition at the National Museum of Canberra is A History of the World in 100 Objects from the British Museum, and it will be there until the end of January. If you want more Christmas listening, my other podcasts include When in Rome, a podcast about place and space in the Roman Empire, with a new episode at the end of the month. And then there's also Biography, where we've just been covering the life of the Greek politician and hero of the Persian Wars, Themistocles. You can like Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can follow both myself and Lily on Twitter. Lily is at Lily Withercombe, that's at LILYWITHYCOMBE. And I'm at Nightlight Guy. The next episode of Emperors of Rome will be on the Roman poet Juvenal. So until then, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.